Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Daegin Adore, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Loretta E. Kim about her new book, Ethnic Chrysalis, China's Orochim People and the Legacy of Qing Borderland Administration, published by the Harvard University Press in 2019. Dr. Kim, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Great. I wonder if you would begin the interview by saying a few words about yourself and how you became interested in East Asian studies and specifically in the Orochim people.
Right. Thank you. First of all, I really have to say that I appreciate this opportunity to introduce my book and to have this conversation with you. So in terms of how I got interested in this topic, I don't think I followed the typical trajectory of knowing exactly what I wanted to do. I like to joke that I migrated from Japan to Korea to China and up north to where I am, kind of nestled between Siberia and Manchuria, a little bit by serendipity. So just to start at the very beginning, I actually thought that I would pursue a career in government service, and specifically in either the Department of Defense or the State Department. And so I thought of my studies as a way to master some expertise about a specific region. And so East Asia seemed like one of the great choices. My other choice was actually Latin America. So you can see, you know, how fortuitous it was that I chose one over the other, so to speak. And then from there, as I moved on from my bachelor's to my master's degree, my interests kind of crystallized a bit, firmed up. I was very interested in Japanese colonialism in Taiwan. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about Taiwan. And then I moved over to the Korean Peninsula because I'm ethnic Korean. And so I started to think about the synergy between Japanese and Korean history. And then to make a very long story short, I thought that I would be most useful to my country, my government, if I concentrated on China, but I was still very much interested in international relations. So I was attracted to China's borderlands. So I thought being posted like somewhere in Shenyang or somewhere or Guangzhou would be great, because then I could have more interaction with places surrounding China. But for various reasons, that didn't quite happen by the end of my doctoral degree program. And so I embarked on thinking about borderlands in a different way, not just as spaces and places, but also the human communities that are living in these places. And perhaps being an ethnic minority person myself, I've always been very much interested in non-Han peoples, and I use that term very explicitly. So I don't think anyone really likes to think of themselves as being part of a majority or minority, especially a minority. But I think what has been really significant in the 20th century for a lot of the people I study is the fact that they are not Han, so they're not part of, you know, the 90% or the 95-97% of people in their country, in their nation. So with that in mind, I turned up north towards, again, the borderland between China and Russia. And I discovered that it's a very diverse place. So there are a lot of myths about Northeast China, that it's very monotonous in every way, the environment is barren and so on. But I discovered that's absolutely not true. And one of the great things about Northeast China, and by that I mean mainly the area of Jilin, Liaoning, and Heilongjiang provinces, as well as Eastern Mongolia, is the cultural and social diversity. So the origin people are just one of the many indigenous populations, you could say, of that region. So I'll talk a little bit more about why I kind of use that phrase gingerly. And so this book is mainly about the origin, but it's also about the region as a whole, as a social space, not so much just as a political or economic one as it has been typically depicted in a lot of other studies.
Oh, that's very interesting. Well, it's quite a journey that you came, right, from, I guess, the study of Northeast Asia in general, and specifically now to the Russian people. And thank you for sharing that with us, definitely. And your book is actually the first monograph-length study on the Russian people in the English language, and that's certainly a highlight. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to write this book?
Yes. Well, again, it wasn't fully formed from the beginning. So my book has a rather complicated origin story. It starts with my doctoral dissertation, where as I was looking at actually the whole region, which is now known as Heilongjiang, and all the people, well, not all the people, some people are so underrepresented in history, they're practically invisible, unfortunately. But anyway, there were a lot of different groups. And this actually happened, again, somewhat by accident. So originally I was looking at another group completely different from the origin, the Shiba people, and how they had migrated from the area, which is now Liaoning province, all the way to Xinjiang. So I was very interested in this, you know, cross-borderland migration process. But the year that I was presenting my prospectus, a wonderful monograph came out about the music and literature of this migration. And so I was floored because it was a great book, but it also covered a lot of topics I wanted to delve into, such as about the effects of migration on ethnic identity and so on. So I immediately changed focus. And when I was in Beijing at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences as a visiting student, my advisor there was very firm and very generous to say, well, why are you limiting yourself to one group? That's too narrow. You should look more broadly, and you can see there's much more going on. And many of these groups that were living in Northeast China during the Qing Dynasty, they had a lot in common, as well as, of course, their distinct characteristics. So you should look at all of them. And so my dissertation immediately just grew into a study of five of these groups. And it became much more exciting, but also somewhat unwieldy. So after I finished the dissertation, I had to figure out, well, how am I going to deal with this, right? So basically, I saw myself writing three different books, and that's kind of happened through different publications. But I decided that the origin are the most fascinating of these groups in terms of what I want to study about how an imperial state deals with indigenous populations and what it means to be living in a frontier zone or a borderland, and a lot of the constructive relationships so that happen. Because I think that often studies want to just focus on conflict. And that is part of the picture, right, of wars and struggles and so on. But then what we end up ignoring are all of these, you could say, productive relationships that also happen. So if I just want to be sensational, I would say that the origin were my favorite because they were the roguish ones, right? They were the ones that were causing trouble, and Qing officials would despair in their memorials to the emperor saying, we don't know how to deal with these people. So there's that kind of an appeal. But then you also see the flip side, where the origin were doing a great deal for the Qing state to hold up the Qing regional administration in Heilongjiang. So I think this really emphasizes and reminds us that we have to see both the constructive and the conflictual aspects of any relationship. So I decided I would focus on that for this particular book, but I will go back to the other groups in other books as I'm doing right now.
Interesting. Now, I guess before we go into the details of the book, can you maybe briefly tell us who the origin people are?
Right. Well, they are, I'll start with contemporary definitions. I think that might be easier. So they are very distinctive in being one of the very smallest groups that are recognized as an ethnic group in China. So I like to call it the under 10,000 cluster of ethnic groups, very, very small ethnic groups. If you're just thinking about population size, the current estimates are that there are only 8,000 to about 10,000 people who identify officially, which by that I mean on their identity cards and so on, as Orichin. But of course, what's involved there is some inherent identity politics, because a lot of these people who identify as Orichin will say to you, you know, privately and personally, well, actually, I'm only part Orichin. So they said, but the other, you know, side of my family is Han or Evenki or some other ethnic identity. So some people express ambivalence about this population count. They are considered as a Tungusic people, if you want to classify them by language. They claim that they are from very up north in what we may consider now as Siberia, as part of the Russian Federation. So a lot of Orichin who are living now do kind of think about those origins, and some of them do maintain relationships with Orichin who are citizens of the Russian Federation. They are originally, and I say this very cautiously because we are very limited in our knowledge of Orichin history and culture, but at least as of the 17th century, they're known for being a people who whose main livelihoods included fishing and hunting. So they're very much living off the land, as most people did, in the forests of Heilongjiang. So they were known as forest people. And they were migratory, kind of like other groups in that area. So they would have some fixed settlements, and then they would move around based on the seasons to find fish or to hunt game and so on. They're organized into clans, which could be then organized into villages or what we might call tribes. They also had very interesting hunting groups that would work together. And these hunting groups were quite democratic in a sense. So they would have a rotating system of leadership. So no one was absolutely the leader all the time. But they, the leader of a hunting group would coordinate the hunt. And that the leader would also make sure that the output, you could say, the produce, whatever they hunted, would be equitably distributed, also given to people who are marginalized in the community or who were disadvantaged, I would say that's more accurate, such as widows and orphan children. They have a lot of rules governing marriage, so they practice exogamy. You have to marry outside of your clan. They have a very fascinating culture of, and that sounds really broad, but I would say that they have a lot of interesting aspects to their culture. That's probably a better way to put it, such as they would create figurines of their ancestors during the Qing, but dressed as Qing officials. So I was in the Provincial Museum of Heilongjiang in Harbin when I first saw one of these figurines. And, you know, at first I thought, ooh, is this kind of like a a voodoo doll, you know, in my ignorance. But then I discovered how sacred these figures are, and how, you know, there's evidence that the origin people during the Qing had absorbed, you know, elements of other cultures, including Manchu culture and what we might broadly call Han culture and so on. So again, right now, there are very few people who are Orichen, who identify as Orichen, who actively practice what you might call as Orichen culture. But I would say overall, it's really amazing to see this cultural group or the social group, if you may, without necessarily labeling it as ethnic or whatever, surviving for centuries.
All right, thank you for giving us a really kind of thorough introduction on the Orochen people. I think a lot of our readers might be wondering about the title of the book, which is a really kind of fascinating title, right? Ethnic Chrysalis. Are you conveying a sense of transformation here?
Right. The title was actually the hardest part of the book. It was harder than writing the manuscript. I was almost concerned that I couldn't publish this book because I didn't have an appropriate title. So I actually had a lot of dreams and nightmares about what to call it. Now I realize, of course, that there are a lot of people who could help with this, like editors and other people involved in the publication process. But basically, I wanted to you know, convey something pithy, right? Something simple and to the point, but also, you know, to make somewhat of a difference, right? So if I just stuck with a very dry title, like what's to the right of the colon in the book title, that may not quite be enough. So in fact, the original title was going to be something that was closer to Human Frontiers. So I was very inspired by Owen Lattimore and other scholars. Notions that, you know, frontiers are determined more by people than by inanimate objects like boundary markers, or even, you know, how boundaries are drawn up in legal treaties and so on. So I want to do something about the Orichen because they were very mobile people. So in fact, prior to the 20th century, they often determined where the actual border between the Chinese state and the Russian state would lie. But then that didn't seem quite right. And so I turned to the other aspect of the book, which is really about ethnicity. But then I had to really figure out my own position about, was there ethnicity during the Qing, pre-modern ethnicity and so on. And after really probing myself and being honest, I decided, well, you know, kind of in the middle, in the awkward middle, in the sense that I would say, yes, perhaps if we went back in time to the 18th century and we interviewed some of these people that I'm studying as respondents, you know, they might say, well, yes, true, you know, we do have a common culture, or yes, yes, we feel very strongly about our shared language or so on. So you could detect elements of ethnicity there, but they wouldn't describe themselves as such, right? So they, I mean, even now, a lot of people who have Orichen on their official identification cards, you know, don't really take stock in that. They said, well, this is just a label. It's not that important to me, or it's not the most important way that I define myself. So why would they in earlier times? So what I want to convey with Chrysalis is that, well, unfortunately, ethnicity is always about evolution. It's always about development. So ethnicity will vary in importance for individuals, for groups over time. At this point, for example, I think that ethnicity does not mean as much as it did 20, 30 years ago to a lot of people in mainland China. So despite the fact that there are still official ethnic policies, there are 56 ethnic groups and so on, these ideas are changing in value, and we have to respect that. And so I wanted to accord the same respect in historical sense and say, well, we're not going to say that, you know, these people that I'm studying became Orichen during the Qing, right? That would be too definitive and too state-oriented. But at the same time, we can't ignore the fact that the Qing state was actively trying to gather more information about these people, to group them, to classify them, and so on. So although I think the ethnic identification project that occurred in mainland China in the 1950s and 60s is considered to be monumental, right? It's highly scientific, rational. It's an anthropological, you know, feat and so on. A lot of what happened then was actually also going on centuries before. So I also wanted to articulate and emphasize that, right? So that China has been going through a very, very long process of understanding what ethnicity means and how to employ ethnicity as a political, economic, and social tool. So in some ways, you could say that people are always living in a chrysalis, that they're always still trying to figure out who they actually are. And it's fine to change. It's fine to kind of shed off one ethnic identity and adopt another, or to adopt multiple ethnic identities and so on. So when I talk to origin people who are living today, you know, of course they do that, especially if they, you know, are actively proud of their blended heritage, right? They say, well, my mother is origin, but my father is Han, or my father's Mongol, my mother is origin, so on and so forth. They're able to fully embrace more than one ethnic identity. And in doing so, they're also enhancing and enriching what it means to be origin.
All right, thank you. I think it's a really thought-provoking title. And maybe let's go into some of the chapters in your book. So chapter one looks at two general strategies developed with the rise of the Qing. One is the military conscription and the other is tribute. And in the book, you kind of mentioned that the origin people at the Qing frontiers were classified into the Moringa origin or the mounted, and then the Yafahan origin or the pedestrian. Can you explain what these categories are and what these two strategies meant for the governance of Qing Manchuria or Northeast Asia?
Certainly. So I think the easiest way perhaps to start is just to admit, you know, that any empire, however mighty or influential, you know, is probably always aware of its limitations. And I think this is very clear with the Qing. So even though now, you know, the official rhetoric is that, you know, the area now previously known as Manchuria, now known as Northeast China, was, you know, always a part of China and so on, that's been a solid part of Chinese territory. Just going back into the 16th, 17th century, you realize that wasn't true, right? There was a lot of ambiguity and perhaps a bit of apathy, right, on the parts of the Ming and Qing government about having complete control at first. Circumstance played a great role in how the Sino-Russian or Qing-Romanov borderland evolved during the 17th and into the 18th centuries. And it took a lot of push and pull negotiation between the two imperial states, but also between the imperial states and the indigenous populations of that region. So, we see this, of course, not only in Manchuria, but other parts of the Qing Empire, namely Mongolia. So we talk about Outer Mongolia and Inner Mongolia and how the Mongols in the outer part, which is farther away from the imperial capital, actually had more autonomy than those who were closer, and they played different roles and so on. Similarly, the division of the origin occurred along similar lines. So at first the Qing state was not very comfortable with the origin that were living relatively farther away from the Qing capitals, right? Whether you're talking about Mukden or Beijing. And they weren't sure what to do with them. So a lot of these groups were not exactly left alone, but they were given more free rein, de facto free rein. So they still had to check in with the officials who were assigned to monitor them. They had to provide tribute in the form of pelts and other things. They would be punished if they committed transgressions and so on. But these are the people we would call the Yafahan origin, or that's what they were called in the documents. And Yafahan means on foot. So they were not granted horses or other resources. They were very much on their own. But they understood they were still within the limits of the Qing Empire, but in a looser sense than Orchin, who were geographically closer in and easier to monitor. And these people were incorporated into the Eight Banners. So their story is perhaps more conventional, or they're more standard. They were like many other indigenous groups, like the Dawur and the Sheba, who were brought in, to use a euphemistic term, into the Eight Banners. And so they were brought in as actually whole groups, as tribes, as families, and so on. And the Qing administration was very practical. They didn't immediately just say, well, you're going to have to convert into so-called full bannermen or be like Manchus. But often these groups, especially at the beginning, they had a Manchu or Mongol, you could say, official who was overseeing them, but their direct leader, so for a particular squad or something, would be someone of their own group, right? So that was a much more effective form of leadership to be, you know, if you report to someone who's directly above you, who is, you know, of the same clan or was previously a leader in your village or something, you immediately accord that person more respect and you value their authority. So this happened with the Moringa Orochin, and Moringa means on horseback. So that's why you might call them the mounted Orochin. So for the Moringa Orochin, the experience is very similar to other Eight Banner groups in Manchuria. Whereas the Yafan Orochin, as they were described in government documents, had a I wouldn't call it an entirely exceptional experience, but a very different experience because of the mobility, the greater freedom they technically enjoyed. But again, there were drawbacks, right? So the Moringa Orochin were like other Manchurian bannermen. They didn't receive the full benefits that, say, a Manchu bannerman in Beijing would receive in terms of material resources or access to government posts or so on. But the Yafahan were completely, again, as I mentioned before, on their own. So they had to figure out a way to fulfill their obligations to the government with, you could say, some support. So for providing the requisite tribute, right, they had a quota for every tribute cycle. If they fulfilled the quota, then they would receive small gifts, right, the ulin. And you could say in some ways this was nominal. This was kind of like getting something back for paying taxes. For the most part, until the early 19th century, I would say that the Yafan Orchin really didn't have many problems with this because, you know, the quota was so small compared to what they were actually able to hunt. So if you had to only submit one or two really good pelts, but you could hunt many animals in a season, then it wasn't very difficult. But over time, of course, it became much more difficult as the supply of animals in the region declined.
All right, thank you. So I guess having the historical background or the contextualization in chapter one, it's a lot more interesting to kind of look at your arguments in chapter two, right? Here you shift your focus to 17th century Heilongjiang in northeast China. And here you show that there was actually mutual influence, right, of the Qing center and indigenous people in the implementations of administrative institutions. So it's not just a one-way kind of relation. So how did they influence or negotiate with one another?
Right. So one of the goals of Chapter 2 was to borrow a common or often used phrase, to rewrite or to bring in, to supplement what's been done before in terms of the narrative. So a lot of previous studies of 17th century Heilongjiang really treat the indigenous people as a Greek chorus, as extras, if you want to use a movie metaphor, that they were kind of shuffled around, manipulated, assigned them very marginal roles and so on. And the way I saw it, it wasn't that way. I mean, of course, if you really just want to focus on everything leading up to the Treaty of Nerchinsk in 1689 as that, you know, you could take that approach. But I saw that really it wasn't, you know, that simple. And as I said before, the Qing was not completely omnipotent in this region. So they were very aware that they had to cooperate, co-opt, do what they could with the resources available to them in the region to influence the people that they wanted to govern. So that was really the foremost goal. So I hope that, you know, from now on, we can continue our dialogue about what was going on in terms of people coming in from the Russian side of the border that would be established, and you know, how they were interacting. So some of the content of this chapter is, you know, very familiar to a lot of readers. Probably the specialists are all very aware of things like the what happened at Yaksa, or otherwise known as Albazin, the clashes between Cossacks and the various indigenous groups there, and so on. But the point is that and ultimately what the Qing had to do is they had to be very pragmatic, and they had to figure out, okay, so how were we going to actually govern these people? And so, as I said before, with the origin, you know, if you tried to kind of literally kind of get all the origin together and have them all be bannermen in a complete sense, to be completely incorporated into the banners, I don't think that would have worked. Right, a lot of them would have just escaped to Russia or Russian imperial territory, which many of them tried to do. They would just say, "I'm not going to stand for this. I'm not going to pay your tribute or you know, be part of your military. So I'm just going to leave." And so I think the Qing was very, very well aware of that. So what they had to do was say, "Okay, what can we actually do? How can we figure out a way to give these people some incentives to remain with us?" To comply with most of our policies, at least, not all the time. There was an 100% success rate. And so that's how I think the, what we might call the Heilongjiang generalship evolves. So the placement of the garrisons, the development of garrisons in different places, as you can see on a map, if you look at a map, they couldn't reach all the way up to the very kind of edge, the northern edge of what is now Heilongjiang anyways. There were, of course, patrols that went around to the eventual borders, but they had to rely on people who were familiar with these areas to do them, right? So if you sent officials who were basically always working at the regional center to do these alone, they wouldn't do a very good job, right? They wouldn't know where to go, what to look for, and so on. But if you send them out, or you have them working with people who really know the terrain, very familiar with the terrain, then you'll get better results. And so I think what it does, if I may use this metaphor or I don't know if it counts as a metaphor, but to put it a simple way, is that really humanizes the Qing imperial state, right? So instead of thinking of it as this machine or something that was very, you know, comprehensive or effective from the start, you actually see it as a thinking, feeling kind of thing. So we see that when the indigenous people would, I don't want to use the term, you know, fight back, because I think that's pejorative, but I think that when they reacted negatively against policies, that the Qing state was able to alter and to modify, right? So, again, instead of just imposing policy after policy, you really see this as a two-way kind of dynamic. And so I think that's how the regional administration up in Heilongjiang was very different than, say, a provincial administration in central or southern China. And it was probably also very different from the other parts of Manchuria. So I think in some ways, the area which is now Liaoning, or the area which is now Jilin, they had other characteristics to deal with. But because Heilongjiang was closest to Siberia, to Russian imperial territory, that there were many more military challenges. You could say there's also a lot of temptation because the Orchin, as well as other people, they really love to trade with Russians, and they didn't want to give that up because of a border or something like that. They would often go and trade with people up there and then come back and say, oh, really? Oh, did I cross the border? So the Qing had to understand that. So Qing officials would complain and say, oh, the Orchin are going up there again and trading with the Russians. But then it was very hard to always implement deterrence.
I see. And this is a really interesting point, because in your narratives in the book, you also point out that the Orientals are not simply loyal subjects or troublesome rebels in the Qing Empire. And this is sort of what you discuss in detail in Chapter 3. Can you maybe tell us a bit more about the specific kinds of roles that the Orientals people played on the Qing territories or the frontiers?
Yes. I mean, those two ideas are obviously very stereotypical of the loyal subject or troublesome rebels. Now, of course, because the origin side of the story during the Qing can't be told from, you know, a direct perspective, because we don't have a lot of extant, you know, materials that can be triangulated and so on and verified as such, you know, it, in some ways, this book has to be very lopsided, right, towards the Qing perspective and how the Orchin were depicted in Qing documents. And as we all know, government documents are always biased, so they're always going to reflect the officials' interests and so on. But in some ways, the officials, you know, would actually include some Orchin voices, and they were also cognizant, or they were trying to build in some rationale for some of the actions. So in terms of the roles they played, well, the Orchin, first of all, were excellent hunters. They were just prolific in that sense. They were known as some of the best hunters in the region, if not the best. The Yafan Orchin would consistently outperform their tribute quotas. So compared to other groups, they would just be racking up the points, so to speak. And they were very good about that. And I think that was much appreciated, of course, because these pelts would go into the imperial coffers. They were also known for being extremely brave, right? So if you're talking about, you know, needing good first line defense for your borderland, the Orchin were it, right? They not only had extensive knowledge of the geography, they were great guerrilla fighters, so they would literally disappear into the forest or the mountains. Much to the annoyance of Qing officials, sometimes they'd say, oh, there, they've gone again. They've just disappeared, right? They're not happy with us, so they've gone away, and then they would reappear later on. But that was very helpful in warfare against both people coming from, you know, the international enemy side, or the inter-imperial side from the Russian side of the border. So if you had incursions from Russian imperial territory, the Orchin would be very brave fighters, but also fighting in the 19th century against people who would be called bandits or so on. So people who are causing disturbances within the region, you know, go send the Orchin out. They will do a great job of dealing with these people. As I said before, they were also very adept at trade. So the Orchin didn't think that a border, especially when set by two imperial states, should limit them in terms of the acquisition of resources. So if they needed to do it, they would cross this border and they would bring back goods from the Russian side of the border. They were also form relationships with Russian merchants who would come into their territory. And these relationships were very practical in a sense. You know, it was about trade, but they also could become very personal. So a Russian merchant could literally be an uncle, or be treated like an uncle in an Orchin clan, and have a long-lasting relationship. They would eat together, drink together, celebrate special occasions together, things like that. And this was also very annoying to the Qing government. They said, you know, the Orchin, they're embracing the culture of the enemy. The women are starting to wear Russian skirts, and why do they want to eat Russian food, and so on. So the Qing officials monitoring the Orchin tried to restrict these kind of practices, but they didn't really succeed because ultimately the Orchon were great cultural intermediaries. They understood Russian culture, or, you know, what we can loosely call Russian culture of the time. Many Orchon became fluent in Russian language as well through these exchanges. We don't know much about their literacy. I'm guessing it was mainly about mastering the oral language, but Orchon also learned Manchu, and they learned the languages of neighboring indigenous groups. So the another role that they would often play is that of interpreter. So if you need someone who had to go up and negotiate with Russian-speaking people, well, you know, please bring an Orchon person with you, and they can do the translation from Russian to Manchu or so on. So those are just some of the roles that they play, but I think they're very important.
All right, thank you. And I guess one important fact, just sort of following up on your previous comment, that the Orchon people did not really have a written language, right? And so how does this complicate our story here?
Right. Well, this is again going to a little bit of a conspiracy theory, but I just think that we have not really discovered Orchon records yet, or records of other groups in Manchuria, that we think too much, too narrowly in terms of script, of texts, the way that they're organized and preserved for, say, the Chinese language tradition or the Manchu or Mongol language traditions. I still believe that the Orchon kept records, which were not all oral. So, of course, we have some oral records that have survived for centuries. But I think, you know, someday we may discover something, be it in terms of a symbol-based language or something. But in terms of the research here, of course, you know, I wanted to be more balanced. I wanted to have an equitable body of sources to work with, but that's just very difficult, right? So we, you know, we can't go back and take testimonials from Orchon living 200, 300 years ago. So I think if that were ever possible, or if we could discover their voices in those alternative written records, that would probably transform the story.
Oh, that's fascinating. I hope we do find something in the future, hopefully. Yeah, and one other really exciting part about the book is, so in the first three chapters, you discuss, of course, the Orchon people, but also their relations with other minority groups in the Manchuria region, such as the Daur, the Hejia, the Xibei, and the Solon people. So can you maybe tell us a little bit more about their relationships?
Certainly, right. So, yeah, it was a tough decision to just put China's Orchon people on the cover as part of the title, because this is not simply a narrative that involves the Orchon. Most simply put, in pre-modern Manchuria, in the pre-20th century, before ethnic classification was really solidified by the Republican and Communist governments, I don't think these people would really have a strong sense of differentiating themselves. I mean, of course, they felt very strongly about belonging to certain clans or villages or so on, but they had a lot of interaction with each other. There was, you know, very intimate interaction, like intermarriage, but just more commonly, these groups would work together in terms of their livelihoods, hunting and fishing together. And so what we really see is this common culture forming in the region. And so I liken that to how people in Northeast China today also feel very strongly. So a lot of them say, well, you know, I think in some ways we are the most integrated region, right? So we don't have all these little local and regional differentiations. We like to be Northeasterners. 我们是东北人, you know, they're really proud of that. And they understand that their culture, or what they consider to be their shared culture, is, you know, very diverse. It's very heterogeneous, that there are elements of all different kind of subcultures mixed in and so on. And what I was trying to think about was how that actually started much earlier on. So again, among all of these people, the Orchon, the Daur, and so on, they interacted a lot. But of course, there were some differences. So the Tao were, for example, because they were completely incorporated into the Eight Banners, they often served as officials who were monitoring other groups like the Origin, right? So you would have Tao supervisors for the Yafahan Origin, and who would have to go into those areas and collect the tribute or count up the tally of the tribute. And relations could be a bit fraught, right? So there are Origin folktale about both good and bad Tao officials, right? So the good Tao officials would be sympathetic, would distribute the adequate number of gifts in exchange for the tribute items and so on. They would be very civil. And then, of course, you have Tao officials who would be exploitative, you know, who would come in and demand more than the tribute quota, or a particularly insidious trick, as we can imagine, would be that the Tao officials would take all the really good pelts for themselves and then report back to the Heilongjiang general that the Origin had failed to meet their quota or were only producing inferior pelts. And so this would upset the Origin greatly. They said, no, we gave you, you know, first-class pelts and you just happened to yourself. So, you know, there was corruption and so on. So there was a mix of positive and negative relationships between these different groups. But what I want to do was show both aspects.
Yeah, definitely. These three chapters are definitely really interesting to read. And I guess towards the end in chapter four, especially, you kind of show that by the mid-19th century, at least former ways of governing the Origin actually became quite unsustainable. Can you tell us why this was the case and then what did the Qing state really do to address this issue?
Yes. Well, I'll start actually on a slight tangent, which is that I didn't want this chapter to be about the decline of the Qing state, because one of my advisors, when I was writing my dissertation, would strongly warn me against being attracted by the framework of imperial decline. And he would say, well, is it ever evident to any state or any community that it is in decline, right? I mean, it's not like you can already predict an endpoint and say, "Oh, there we are, we're going down." So it's not really about that, but actually quite the opposite. Even though the former strategies and the institutions set up in the 17th and 18th century were not working as well in the 19th century, that this is a phase in which the Qing state tried to be resilient and try to maintain control, but again in a inherently flexible way. So by adapting, by changing so much, which, you know, from our perspective in the present day could be seen as a sign of weakness, it was actually a form of exerting or trying to maintain strength. So in terms of the reasons why the institutions weren't working, first of all, we have environmental changes. So despite the Origin being very talented hunters, they simply just couldn't hunt as much as before because the Qing tribute quotas depleted the natural populations of fur-bearing animals. So other scholars have looked into this, of course, very recently, and it was just very, very hard, right? So Origin hunters would have to go farther and farther, especially away from their home areas, to seek out animals that would yield the high quality pelts that the Qing administration demanded. And this became more difficult. And they would complain about it. They would say, I've gone really far. I've tried really hard. I've worn out my horses trying to get you your pelts, but this is not happening. So they would say, could you reduce the quota? Could you suspend the quota? So on and so forth. And then you could see some people were acting out of desperation. So some Origin would say, we just can't live under this regime. So we're going to go up to Russia. And so that would weaken the border or the sense of the border between Russia and Qing territory. And so that became more difficult to deal with. And so in some ways, the Qing reacted by trying to pull or literally draw these Origin people in. So they did this most significantly with the Yafahan, right? They said, well, okay, the Yafahan used to have a lot of mobility, but now we're going to mandate that they attend these military training drills, that they report to us more frequently so that we can increase our surveillance of them. But of course, that would, you know, backfire. So that worked to a point, but some of the Yafan origin would say, well, why should I show up, right? What's the incentive? I don't get anything out of it. Well, I might get a little something out of it, but, you know, it's not worth the effort, and so on. So throughout chapter four, you can see that there were all these different strategies that they're trying to use, whether it was setting up a new garrison or trying to create incentives for Origin to be loyal and so on. But again, this is all supposed to be contextualized in a spirit of resilience. So the Qing wasn't just giving up and saying, okay, we're going to throw up our hands, we can't deal with these people anymore. They were trying their best to maintain some degree of control.
I see. I guess the final chapter, or the fifth chapter, kind of follows this period, but also reflects the effects of the Origin experience during the Qing, and also a modern Origin identity. So how has the identity for the Origin people been characterized since the fall of the Qing Empire, especially in the 20th century and beyond?
Right. Well, this is a very interesting question, because a lot of the shaping of the Origin identity has actually still come from states, whether it was people writing regional gazetteers during the Republican period, or officials, cadres, conducting the ethnic identification project in the area, and thereby saying these people are Origin and these people are not. But interestingly enough, if we do think about the sort of folk elements or the non-political ideology-driven elements of this identity, they really connected back to what happened during the Qing. So this is true for the Origin, also for the Daur, Evenki, Shiba peoples. They feel very strongly, they're very proud of the fact that their ancestors played significant roles as borderland defense forces, that they provided tribute to the Qing Empire. And these memories or these precedents are seen as badges of honor. And so even though these groups are relatively small in the greater, you know, scale or spectrum of the PRC, that they thought that they were very distinctive in this way, that they're heroes, that they still embody these, you know, martial traits, that they are honorable and brave and so on. So that got factored in. I think a lot of that was absorbed into the definition of who they are after 1950. But on the other hand, you know, the Origin have also been seen as still being very primitive, and that's very politically incorrect. But, you know, they're seen as being, oh, primordial, and they have these very traditional ways of hunting and fishing. And so present-day Origin also have to grapple with that, right? Because it's very hard to just envision yourself as being, you know, that way, and then trying to be proud of that, you know, rather than being modern and sophisticated and so on. So in chapter five, I was helping the reader, you know, go through all of these different layers, right? And this goes back to the idea of a chrysalis, that the Origin identity may have always existed in some sense, right? So that's kind of the caterpillar inside the chrysalis, but then all these layers have been added, and some of them have been added by Origin people themselves, and others have been added by people who are not Origin, and so they've encapsulated and kind of embodied what it means to be Origin. But I would say, you know, individually, the layers wouldn't make sense, that you have to see them all together as an integrated whole.
I see. Oh, thank you for that. And I guess lastly, there is one, fact that you mentioned towards the end of the book, that in the 1950s, especially the Origin were actually forced to integrate into communities in which their minority status meant that they had to, for example, intermarry and to rely on other languages for communication. And then as a result, many Origin began to lose their native tongue. So what does this mean for the future of the Origin people?
Yes, this is an issue that I've been thinking about for a long time, and I'm really inspired by a lot of people who claim ethnic minority identity in mainland China and the PRC, irrespective of if their origin or otherwise. This notion of, you know, how connected do you have to be to your ancestral culture or your native culture, and part of that is language. So yes, a lot of origin were compelled or maybe incentivized to marry outside of their ethnic group. To marry up, so to speak, right? So an origin person marrying a Han person was considered, that's a great improvement. Their children will be better off for it. And also to use Chinese as their primary language of communication and so on. And of course, you know, I want to follow along with what actually makes sense for people. So I started out my career, you know, thinking of ethnicity as a kind of an ideal to be achieved, to be embodied and so on. And then more and more I've become more practical about it, right? So in some ways, this book is an elegy to ethnic identity in China, because I feel like in the decades to come, ethnicity will mean something very different, or mean maybe almost nothing at all to most people, whether they are part of the ethnic minority or part of the ethnic majority, I would say, or the ethnic minority groups that are officially and legally prescribed as such. So for language, it's tricky, because going back to people who talk to me now, they say, well, I don't speak my language. I don't speak my ancestral language. Am I still a part of my ethnic group? And I respond, well, yeah, if you want to be, you know, I mean, I'm not going to dictate to you, yes, you are, or you're not. But if you want to be, right? So what that means is, I would say, just recalibrating your expectations or kind of thinking in a different way, right? So what does it mean to be origin without being proficient in origin language? I think it's still possible, right? It's no less authentic. But then, of course, you know, there are some calls, not so much in the past few years for the obvious political reasons, but and the constraints imposed on a lot of ethnic groups. But you know, they say, well, you know, can we revive it? Can we bring back the language, or can we make the language more relevant? Because that's one of the major problems, right? Many origin will say, so what is the point of me learning origin? It's not a practical language. I can't surf the web in origin, you know, unless there are resources, right? If someone builds, you know, origin web pages, well, maybe that might change things, right? Much like Mongols, you know, Mongols in the PRC can still, you know, keep their language alive through using a lot of media and so on and so forth. But for many of these groups, they just don't see the value of it. So I think what we're going to have to do, if we want to support groups like the origin, is to do this kind of development and preservation work. But on the other hand, you know, even though I work on ethnic studies and ethnic history, if it becomes irrelevant, if it becomes obsolete, then we also have to embrace that too, right? So there's no point in saying, but you have to maintain your ethnicity so I can study you. You have to say, all right, well, you know, that might be a historical phenomenon. That was something that was relevant to you in the past, but it isn't now, and that's completely fine.
Yeah, definitely. I guess we've taken up a lot of your time already. Our final question would be, are you currently working on any projects that you can tell us about?
Oh, I'd be happy to. So I'll just mention two things that I'm doing right now. First of all, I'm working on a name lexicon data set of names of non-Han individuals in the area, you know, roughly that we would call Northeast China from 1600 to the present. So it's been this really exciting endeavor of just going through all these different sources and finding all these, discovering all these names. And just briefly, I'm doing this for two reasons. First of all is the preservation aspect. So when people ask me, can you give me an example of an origin name or dower name? I want to say, sure, there are all of these different names. And this is especially true for people who claim this heritage or claim this as part of their heritage. So if there's a dower person who wants to name him or herself a dower name, you know, I want them to have something to go to, kind of like a baby book. So there's that aspect. But the scholarly aspect, I would say, is to broaden our understanding of Manchurian culture, a Manchurian society, which I think has been heavily dominated by Manchus, right? The notion of the Manchu language being supreme in that area, the early modern period and so on. So in fact, we've discovered that there are many names which you might consider to be Manchu names, but actually originate in non-Manchu groups. But these groups mm-hmm. have marginalized or pushed out or their origins have been obscured or so on in these names. So it's bringing that back into the light. So that's the point of the name Lexicon. And the second project, which is also coming through in a book, is about food culture. And I'm not a food historian, but I've been very much influenced by both food historians and environmental historians. So what I'm actually looking at is how Northeastern food culture has evolved as a heterogeneous, you could call it multi-ethnic, poly-ethnic kind of thing. And this ties back to my earlier comments about Northeast China being a place which is very inherently, you know, embracing of different cultures. So, you know, a lot of people will say to me, oh, Northeast Chinese food is terrible. It all tastes the same. It's the same five ingredients, you know, combined together in different ways. They're so, you know, poor in resources there. And then if you go back into history, of course, that's not true, that you'll see that, you know, literally there are all these recipes that bring in the diverse animal and plant resources of the region and so on. So to me, you know, this is kind of my tribute to how diverse and interesting Northeast China actually is.
Wow, these are really unique and exciting projects. I'm definitely looking forward to learning more about them. I'm sure our readers as well. Well, I think we're done with our podcast, but before we hang up, I just want to say that I had a really great time reading your book. This is definitely something that our readers want to pick up if you're interested in East Asian history, especially Northeast Asian history. So definitely check out Dr. Loretta Kim's new book on the Origin People. And thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us about your wonderful projects.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.